Welcome to the April 27th, 2021 session of Tangerine SDR and HAMSI technical session. My name is Dave, KV0S. And this week, I've been working on, I'm still dealing with the book a little bit, and which is my past job, and have been dealing a little bit with the Whisper transmitters that Tapper works with, and I haven't actually gotten much programming on my simulator, although I did get all the libraries I need for both CRC32s and SHA-256s in multiple languages. So we're getting close. That's it for me. Next on the list is Nathaniel W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathaniel.
Thank you very much, Dave. I've been continuing to work with students and collaborators on the different projects. Things are coming along, doing a bunch of data analysis. Let's see, I ordered a Max 10 development board, which came in, and I have promptly given it away to my student Kung. So hopefully, he seemed very excited to get it today. So hopefully this summer, he'll be able to make some good use of it for the project.
Very good.
Back to net.
Next on the list, we have Bill, AB4EJ. Go ahead, Bill.
Okay, thanks, Dave. Good evening to you and good evening to the net. Been busy this week. My students got the first pass of the central control system API running on the server we're going to actually run it on. And I just today got the local host to where it can send a heartbeat to the central control system using production code. And today all it gets back is an acknowledgement, either yay or nay, that it was a good get. We will add the capability for the central control system to send things like commands of various kinds, like data requests and things like that, to the local host. So we've got the first step of that working. Also, I got working on the central control system, the first implementation of using Mapbox, which is something similar to the way Satnogs displays. When you go to Satnogs' homepage, they display all of the implemented satellite monitoring systems that they have in place. Well, what we'll do is we will show the location of all of the tangerines that are at least in a semi-connected, either fully connected or semi-connected state. If they've been offline for a while, we'll probably drop them after a certain amount of time. But anyway, so we've got the ability to do it's just a blank map right now, but I've got to add some code in there where it goes into the database and is able to extract the lat longs of all of the online stations and then show them as icons on the map. So back to net.
Very good, Bill. And next on the list, we have Dan in for XWE. Go ahead, Dan. Dan, are you there? Well, we'll come back to Dan. Next on the list would be Bill in 8ET. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, I don't have too much. I've been pretty busy working on the R2 Pro board. Got my last board to do on that. I have to wind toroids, and I'm discovering it's pretty difficult winding toroids with one hand and left-handed. So I'll get through that tomorrow. But other than that, I haven't done anything at all on this project. So we'll be back next week.
Well, welcome back, and we'll be happy to have you next week too. So. Next on the list, it looks like Dan didn't come back. We got David McGaw, N1HAC. Go ahead, David.
Hello, everyone. Not too much to report. Continuing to work on rockets and ground-based receivers, and looking forward to being able to input on VLF board, see how the clock board's going, all that. Look forward to the discussion at the end. Back to net.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have Dev, KC3 PVE. Does your mic work? Dev, are you there?
Yes, does it work? Hello?
Hello? Yes.
Yes. So I'm connected through phone, and throughout the day I'm having trouble with my laptop. Zoom audio. I'm not sure what's going on. Otherwise, we are having a good start of the week. And we're working on projects with the students. And I'm teaching, I think, my final chapter for a course that I'm helping Nathaniel with. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Next on the list, we have Gary, AF8A. Go ahead.
Hey, good evening, everyone. I've been working a little bit this week with Jim, K4BSE, on the Gen 1 GRAPE documentation. I think we've got one more wrinkle to solve on the introductory document. And then Jim can think about how we want to post that. And then we'll start working on a hints and hacks for anyone who wants to consider building a Gen 1 GRAPE. So that's it. Back to that.
Very good. And next on the list, we have Homan Kim, KD2MCR. Go ahead.
Yeah, good evening, everyone. I've been pretty busy with some other matters, so nothing really to update today. So I'm just looking forward to listening to what other people will be talking about. So back to Ned.
Well, fine business. And next on the list, we have James, KG4DSG. Go ahead, James.
Evening, all. Missed a couple of weeks for other prior commitments, couldn't get out of, but I'm back and listening and eager to hear what's happened since I've been gone. So with that, back to the net.
Very good. And next on the list is Jay. I don't remember if a call sign, Jay. Sorry.
Oh, go ahead. Whiskey Bravo 8, Sierra Bravo India.
Okay.
I got the Scotty, I got these two boards. Thank you very much, Scotty. And now I just got to figure out how to hook them up and use them. But this next couple of weeks is going to be rather difficult for me. I'm in a week from today, I have to have some surgery. So I'm in sort of that's occupying my time getting ready for that. And so I'm going to be confined to quarters, and it's going to happen next Monday, and it's going to take me out of circulation for a week or so. So I'm going to be laying low, recovering from that. But it'll give me a good chance, a good excuse just to play FT8 all the time. Otherwise, I'm just trying to keep my arms around these things. One thing with this great project that has happened to me is because of the fact several years ago, we had a flood here in the Detroit area, and I had to clean out my basement because the basement needed to be rebuilt. The man cave had to be totally rebuilt. And one of the things I didn't do is I didn't rebuild my test bench since then. So now I've got to go through and rebuild my test bench and get surface mount tools and a magnifier and appropriate soldering iron. So that's one thing I may be reaching out to the group for help of. Now, having not worked with surface mount ever, I'm good at soldering a PL259. I can do that, no problem. But, surface mount, I got to go through the learning curve on this. So if anyone could comment here tonight, what kind of soldering tool? Is it a hot air soldering tool, or is it actual an iron that I should be getting to solder surface mount here? So that's my question for tonight. So back to Ned from WB8SBI.
Well, very good. And I'll throw in my 1-2 cents. Get yourself a binocular microscope if you don't have one. They're not that expensive, but they sure help seeing those little pins. Next on the list, we have Jim, K4BSE. Jim, are you there? I see him there, but I don't see any voice or Well, maybe we'll get back to Jim. I see Dan, so why don't we grab Dan while he's there. Dan in for XWE.
Oh, thanks, Dave, and good evening, everyone. Yeah, I had a little issue with my PC. It started right, I don't know what happened, but it started running Zoom as a zombie application. So no matter what I did, I couldn't reboot it. And then it took me about 6 or 7 minutes to let the thing reboot. Anyway, don't have much to add to the conversation except that Ubuntu Mate 21.04 was released last week. The Raspberry Pi version has not been released yet. It generally lags about 3 or 4 weeks behind the main release. Interestingly, Ubuntu Mate is now used, or will be with 21.04, will be using Python 3.9 as the default okay. installation, which I think is helpful for Bill. I think it is. I'll let him comment on that, but I think it should be a good thing for us. Anyway, that's it from here.
Fine business. And let's see. I think the next on the list is Jonathan, KC3EEY. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Hi, everybody. I don't have much to report. I'm working pretty deeply in my LaTeX book project. It was also a bit of an emotional day for me because this was the day that I went to pick up my graduation gown. That's coming up in a about a month or so, and thank you. And I was interested in doing a little bit of discussion on the VLF receiver, if the if those differential transmitters and receivers are not obsoleted, even though that they are hard to find right now, why don't we just stick with them and we'll just stock them when they get stocked? I mean, if it's going to be stocked in November or, you know, sometime this fall, maybe this summer. Other than that, that's all I have. Back to the net.
Well, fine business. And Jim, did your mic work? Jim Farmer? No signal. Also on the list, Dave Witten, KD0EAG, jumped in. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello. I think I was having some of the same problems that Dan was having. I went to open up the Zoom session nice and early, about 10 till, and it went zombie on me, and I had to, I tried shutting everything down. Finally, I had to shut the whole machine down, and then that went to doing some, you know, who knows what it was doing, but it takes a long time to reboot. So I went to my other machine and at the other end of the house, and the mice, all the batteries and all the mice were dead. And so I had to come back and get some batteries. And then this machine was up, round and round it goes. So Zoom, here I am, for what it's worth. Otherwise, not a lot to report. I've just been doing fooling with magnetometers in Python, mostly from Raspberry Pi Picos and some other little widgets, that sort of thing. Nothing of compelling interest to this group, I don't think. Thank you.
Okay, well, next on the list, we have Jules, K2KG. Isn't there a J in there?
Yeah,
oh, I got it. That's true.
All right, Dave. Hello to the net. Nothing new to report this week. A little late this evening. I was tied up in the middle of an experiment. No problems with Zoom, but just got in late. The magnetometers keep recording well. I haven't had a chance to do some graphical analysis recently. Apparently, we had a flare that passed by the mass ejection that passed by the Earth and created a bit of a geomagnetic disturbance. Maybe Hillman has something to report on that. I haven't had a chance to graph my latest results, so which I'll do in the next day or two. Back to net.
Jules, what day was the flare?
That was on the, I believe it was the 24th, just before midnight UTC. It wasn't a flare, actually. As I say, it was a CME that passed by the Earth.
Okay.
And but it did raise storm level to a G4, I believe.
Okay, thank you. I'll check my log for that.
Right.
Next on the list, we have John, KJ6, IBP. Go ahead, John.
Speaking of flares, will this equipment let us know if there's currently a CME hitting the Earth?
I guess that's would be eventually a question for Bill, if he's planning to put any flare detecting.
Well, my experience has been, just in watching the output from the grape over the course of the past couple of weeks, I did see a dramatic change in what was being displayed on the waterfall on the grape. And we don't have that kind of thing running for the tangerine yet, but with a little bit of coaching, you should be able to look at it and tell. Now, I mean, currently there is no plan to put some sort of artificial intelligence kind of system in there to detect when that's actually happening. But there are ways to look at the signal and say, hey, I see something that based in the past has been a flare. So, I mean, that's potentially possible to do, but that's not necessarily part of phase one.
I have something to add. I was looking at the NOAA website, and they've made some additional. They have a radio web page, electrical engineer circuit web page, and they have one for space enthusiasts. And the one for space enthusiasts has quite a bit of information that's useful to this group, and it does report flares there. So,
what page was that?
The NOAA space weather site. If you get space weather, there's a commercial site that has lots of nice pictures and a little bit of telemetry, but the NOAA site has much more, and they have pages that are customized to the things you're interested in, and ours are either radio or the space enthusiasts.
Okay, I had to restart my computer. I think I got my problems set now. Thanks.
Okay. Did you want to make any comments?
Well, let's see. Gary mentioned some of what we were doing, working up the help pages, getting that started. I'm trying to get the get a form up there that people can fill out and send that will let them put their question in. I'm having a little trouble with it, but I will get in touch with someone if I need to. I did finish my grape one, at least the mixer board, and it seems to work okay. I've been trying to try it out on WWV, but since Thursday when I got it working, propagation has been so lousy on 5 and 10 megahertz, I haven't been able to do anything. This far away, 2.5 is useless, but 5 and 10 usually come in pretty good, but not now. That's about it.
Okay. Well, thank you, and glad you got your Zoom working. Next on the list, we have Michael, AAAK. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, thank you, Dave. Greetings to everyone listening. We just had an unexpected or unforecast thunderstorm, so I may disappear yet. Back to you, Dave.
Fine business. Next on the list, let's jump down and grab Veronica, KD2 UHN. Go ahead, Veronica.
Hello, everyone. So lately, I have been working on, I just submitted a paper to IEEE for a paper contest they're having in my area. I got the results back. I came in fourth, which.
Very good.
Very close to third, but not quite. And then I'm working on turning that paper into a rough draft for Dr. Vercel's space physics class. And then in space physics class, Dev just taught us a very nice lesson today about auroras. And then more so pertaining to the grape, I have been working with, so Claire from Dartmouth has sent us a little bit of her code, and I've been working to kind of apply that cross-correlation method with the data that I have from my grape and then the folks at Case Western and JIT, their grapes as well. And then aside from that, tomorrow our radio club is going to help out Dr. Purcell with setting up some antennas, and I'm very excited for that. And then also, not so much with ham radio, but it might be of interest. I registered for the NASA Rock On workshop, and I just got the box of all the components for that. So hopefully soon I'll start assembling that.
Yeah. Very good.
Thank you. Back to you.
Yes, sounds wonderful. So next on the list, we have Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Hey, Dave. Very good. Thank you. This week's been kind of busy getting the final parts orders in. We did manage to find some of the Ethernet parts. Unfortunately, we need 25 of them. We ended up having to buy about 200 of them because it's a minimum order. But hey, that's okay. Nobody else has them. They're not going to be out until October. So I figure I could take the extra ones and sell them on the gray market and probably make our money back that we paid for the 200 of them. So we'll see how that goes. Maybe look for them on eBay, right? Anyway, and also continuing on the pin swapping for the data engine, our CAD guy is doing an amazing job. We did the pin swapping for the USB 2 port, and I think he got all of the wire, all the connections between the FPGA and the USB controller all on one layer, because we organized the wires so there's no crossovers, because on the FPGA we can do that. So we're continuing on with that. And once we get that done, then I'm going to want to get with you, Tom, and we're going to go over the connections to the RF module and make sure everything is connected up properly so they'll work when we plug them in. Clock module essentially done, waiting for some cleanup and to make sure that we don't have to change anything based upon what happens on the data engine. So it's like a jigsaw puzzle with all not necessarily interlocking parts, but they're all interdependent. So, and they can, each side can be moved. So you want to pick the most optimum for both sides. So I think that's about it. So back over to you, Dave.
Well, fine business. And I think the next on the list is Tom, M5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave. Good evening to everyone in the group. Let's see. This week, I got the test set up for measuring the third order intermod performance of the receiver set up and running. I managed to borrow an HB8560B signal generator and built a resistive combiner and was able to take data that looks reasonable on the Hermes. The nice thing about the Hermes is there's a wideband mode, so you can see the raw ADC samples, and that makes finding the clipping level and full scale on the A to D converter very easy to do. You just run it in wideband mode, twiddle the attenuators until it comes down off the rails. And I have some unusual artifacts in the third order IMD. I think the generators are talking to each other through the power combiner. But other than that, I'm getting reasonable third order intermod numbers on Hermes. And so I think we have a good test setup now to measure the dynamic range of the tangerine. So back to the net.
Well, fine business. And I think that's the end of our list. So we should go for open discussion. Have I missed anybody? Hearing none, we're open.
This is AB4EJ. I had a question for Tom McDermott. Dealing with the question has to do with the size of a waterfall display in GNU radio. Is there any reasonable way other than going down and modifying the Python deep down inside of the block to control the size of the waterfall display? Like right now, it looks like it shows about 6 hours worth of the waterfall. And I was thinking there would be certain advantages if I could enlarge it to show 24 hours, but do you know any way to customize that?
Well, the in terms of the display extent, there are a couple of parameters in the tab, the column and column count and row count. So you can set up the number of columns and number of rows. Those are selectable through the GUI for the waterfall. You'll find a couple of parameters. It's a very cryptic field. It says like display, and it's got, you know, comma separated numbers in the display to select row, row count, column, column count. But that just controls the extent of the waterfall on the display itself. How many rows it can occupy, how many columns it can occupy, and where it sits with respect to the other GUI elements. I fear trying to get 24 hours of pixels may be difficult because I think you run into a problem. You'd probably need to display about 10,000 pixels in height to get them all on there. And so I'm not sure there's an easy way to do that.
Well, I'm looking at the property of QT GUI waterfall sync.
Okay.
And I don't see anything about columns and rows here.
Okay, let me fire up a VM and go take a look and find where it is. And I'll tell you where on the menu it is. Hang on.
Okay, it may not be in the QT side, but anyway, yeah, I'd be more interested to learn something about that.
Yeah, I know. It's definitely in QT, but I forget where it is. Okay.
Yeah, it would definitely require a tremendous amount of memory, but nowadays with the Raspberry Pi going up to 8 gigabytes in RAM, maybe we can do it. We'll see, but let me know what you figure out. Thank you very much, Tom.
Yeah, the difficulty is that if you're trying to express 24 hours and each pixel is, you know, 10 seconds, then you have 8,000 something pixels vertically per column to represent 24 hours. And how do you display 8,000 pixels?
Yeah, vertically? I know what you mean. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, back to Net, and Tom can break in when he has something else to report on that.
For Jay, and you're building your station. I'm going to have to turn off my background video here. Otherwise, you're never going to be able to see this. So 1 second. Okay. I use these, a pair of optimizers, and you can put a magnifier on one eye, and you can put an LED light on the headband. And don't get the cheap ones. Get the $70 or $80 ones that are glass lenses.
Okay.
If you get plastic lenses, you'll sooner or later you'll melt one with your soldering iron. Also, don't bother if you think, oh, I need lots of magnification. Don't get the 10x model, because the focal length is so short that you won't be able to really use it. You're going to have to get so close to your soldering iron, you're going to burn your nose. So it's, I think I use a 2.5x or 3x for the main lens part here, and then another 2.5 for this. So when you put them together, you know, you get almost 10x.
I was thinking of getting, I saw it on Amazon, it's a microscope stand that has a display panel on it, so that I didn't have to wear a headpiece.
Yep. Those are awesome, except my only problem with fixed microscopes, whether it be an optical one or a digital one, digital ones are good because you can move the work around and get it so that you can see it and then stop touching it and it stays. The problem is with the I can't ever get the optical ones to stay put, to keep the work in the right place, or I move the microscope, or like especially the ones that have the circular light in them with the magnifier in the middle, they never stop moving. It's like, you know, the your exhaling moves, makes a thing move, and then the focal length changes. And so something attached to your head is really good because it's fixed between your eye and the lens because it's around your head. So there's never any, you just move your head forward or back to focus.
What I was also going to get, there's a stand of it. It's got four from, you know, the four corners. It's got clips on the four corners. So you can put the work mounted on the stand and put that stand underneath the scope. Therefore, the stand is holding the circuit board and I'm got both my hands free.
And it has adjustable height, right? So you can adjust the focus on either the stand or the microscope?
I would assume so, yes.
Yeah.
Or I can move the work up and down. I can move the vice anyway I want.
Other thing on the microscope, the microscope that I've got here has a
fluorescent light fixture around the lens opening that slips on. So it gives you lots of light. And actually, one of the things that I did find useful is if you could find them at flea markets usually, or you can find them on eBay, is their octopus lights. So they have a power supply that's big and heavy. And then they have, it's a halogen, usually a halogen light, which you may be able to fix using LEDs these days. But these are usually pretty inexpensive and they give out a ton of aimed light. And I got one with two goosenecks on it. So you can put them down on either side of the work and you can just flood the work with light, which really helps for us guys with old eyes to get more light on the work because it increases the depth of field.
So, this is going to take some effort on my part. Now, the boards that you sent me, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
What looks like the magnetometer board, has that got three sensors on it? Because it looks like an X, Y, and Z.
That's correct. That's right. It's a three-axis magnetometer.
Yeah. It looks like what we did in automotive where you got roll, pitch, and yaw.
Yep.
Okay. Now, other than a power supply and some cabling, are these boards ready to go? I mean,
you should be able to plug the board without the magnetometer module onto a Raspberry Pi 3.
Yeah.
And you should be able to connect the other board with the Cat 5 cable, and you should be able to run Dave's software and talk to the board.
Okay.
And however you mount it, like the way Dave is doing it, or the way Jules is doing it, any of those ways are good.
Yeah. So, all right. Yeah. As mentioned, this is going to be at least a couple weeks delay here while I recover from surgery.
I actually use an Odroid N2, but you could use a Pi 3 or a Pi 4.
And I've used a Nano.
Well, I want to use something that's got enough memory on it, you know, enough capability to, how do I want to say it? Future-proof it, if possible.
Well, I will tell you, I've been collecting data since June, and I haven't filled up a drive yet.
And the beauty of it is, as far as future-proof, when your Raspberry Pi runs out of oops, throw it in the trash. It's only $35. Buy another one. Buy something bigger. By the time that happens, the $35 will buy you something bigger. So
now, does that board, okay, so it's out there, it's collecting data. Does it upload it to my local hard drive here on my machine, or where's that data go?
It currently stores on the whatever computer board you attach to it, and I'm using rsync to upload it to a site that Dave Witten has, so that we're experimenting with the Linode site. So everything that I'm collecting, I put up on Dave's site. We haven't made it official for everybody to link to it yet, but we're testing it. And the biggest issue is just getting the passwords set up.
Yeah, okay. That's a start. So the other thing, Scotty, is, When soldering surface mount components, do I want an iron or a hot air gun?
The answer to that is yes.
Yeah, that's right. Right. I don't have any hot air other than speaking to you guys here. And aside from that, I do have a heat gun, and you can build yourself out of an old Coke can and a pair of scissors a shield that will shield everything on the board except the part you want to unsolder, and that works pretty well with a heat gun without frying everything.
Right,
well-focused hot air device is actually quite helpful in working with surface mount. And you can get Pace or Weller or other solder stations that have a nice fine-tipped soldering iron and hot air and a solder sucking tool, all of which are useful.
Have you seen those ones on eBay for under $200? Is that the ones you're talking about, Dave?
I'm talking about the expensive ones, you know, Pace and the name brand. But yeah, I'd be interested if anyone's gotten one of the cheap ones and whether it actually works.
There's a number of YouTube reviews on them that are pretty truthful, and you get what you pay for.
Yeah, because the ones that the name brand ones are like in the $1,500 range.
Yeah,
I looked on the Weller website, you know, $1,500, and it was like, no, not going to happen.
Yeah, but again, yeah, there are the cheap Chinese ones that probably are perfectly good if you can find reviews of the actual item.
The one color I've used is a WSD51. Have you used that one, Dave? That's pretty.
Yes. Yes.
It's under $200. In fact, it's closer to $100 than it is to $200. Mm-hmm. And the TC2000 is the next step up, but it's about $250 on DigiKey. Nice, very nice irons. But and the other thing I would recommend, and I bought all my irons at flea markets, and you can find, I found a TC2002, one of the LCD models and all that, $10 the guy wanted for it. It was like, okay. I don't think he knew what it was. It was in an estate, and he just said, oh, you know, 10 bucks and you can have it.
That's what you call a hot iron.
Anyway, so I would also recommend getting yourself maybe one that, like, I use a WTCP, which is temperature control, but it's controlled by the tip that you put in it. And it's really interesting. It's got a reed switch in the heater, and they use a magnet in the tip comes with a magnet in it that loses its magnetism at a certain temperature, which then opens the switch and turns off the iron. And then when it cools down a little, it closes the switch. So you buy a 600, 700, or 800 degree tip to put in it. So it's pretty crude, but what I use it for is to unsolder components, because if you put an iron on either side of a two-pin component, you can take it off real easily.
Right, now I just want to get it on there.
Yeah.
So
all you need is,
well, those are, I use those all the time, and it's very effective. It uses to be technical, it has a controlled Curie temperature in the tip that controls, you know, when it's above a certain temperature, it goes non-magnetic, the power switches off to it.
But the point is that it's a fixed temperature.
The tip gets controlled, you know, the tips are a controlled temperature. You buy which ones temperatures you want. I always use the higher temperature ones. I like high temperature, quick work.
Yes. For unsoldering, I turn it all the way up. For soldering, you want to be a little more careful, especially like if you're soldering germanium transistors or something. But my advice for SMT is, if you can't poke yourself with the tip and draw blood, it's not small enough. That's just rule of thumb.
But there are some very fine tips you can get for that particular iron.
And then the other trick is, if you get a very fine tip, don't get a long one. You might think, oh, well, that length is really nice to stay away from the components. But the problem is, it sucks the heat away from the tip, and you can't supply enough heat with conduction through a half inch long tip to unsolder, like, for instance, a component that has a ground that's connected to ground without a thermal.
Yeah, for the Weller TCP series, you want a PTP-8 or a PTP-7.
Right.
Papa Tango Papa is the finest point they make.
And okay. And the thing about the WES, you could buy tips for it. And I have, it's a 50-watt iron, but it's temperature controlled, so that you're not going to burn anything up with the 50 watts, except if you put a stubby tip on it, you can actually solder copper clad boards together to make cases out of it. If you use a very short tip that's fat.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what are some of the model numbers? Scotty, you said WSD Whiskey Sierra Delta 51.
Right.
Who makes that?
Weller. It's a Weller.
Okay.
It's kind of like their hobbyist version.
Okay, what was
the- Just remember, Weller swallowed Unger and maybe some other things too. So there's some mixed numbers in there.
Fine. And there was another one you said, TC, Tango Charlie.
WTCP, I think it's, is there a T at the end? You remember WTCP is the one I remember.
Yeah, that's, there are a couple of models of it. WTCP is the basic one.
Right, yeah. And it's got the Curie element in it that you buy the 6, 7, or 8. And like Jules said, 7 or 8 is the tip that you want. And the tip, by the way, when you take the tip out and you look at the base, the number's stamped right on the base, 6, 7, or 8.
How many
WTCPT?
Yeah, and that's what I probably... 30 or 40 watt iron, maybe. I'm not sure.
The wattage, I forgot what it is, but yeah, it's sufficient.
Mine is a 60 watt, but they're roughly 50 watts. And as you say, Scott, if you put the heavy tip on it, you can solder darn near anything with it.
Yeah, and yeah, I use the mid-size conical for most work. And then there is the long thin tip, which I use for surface mount when you don't need a lot of heat, but you need a very fine tip.
Okay, so unfortunately, DigiKey doesn't have any in stock, so I can't give you a price, but I can give you the link to it so you can go from there. Okay.
Yeah, I'm going through the learning curve on everything surface mount.
That's the WTCPT iron.
I got, okay, I see the chat. I'm copying it now. And
let's see. Yeah, there's nothing worse than a crummy soldering iron to ruin your experience with SMT.
And yeah, I think they don't have any in stock.
Yeah, so go to Mauser and see if you can find that same part number.
Okay.
And Hakko, H-A-K-K-O, that's a good brand. What was the other one you mentioned, Dave, that was other than Weller? I think you said there was a name of one that you had mentioned.
Dave, your phone, microphone.
You can usually find the Wellers at flea markets.
Yeah. Another company is Pace, P-A-C-E.
Okay.
And if you want to save a ton of money, go to Alibaba and there's any number of knockoffs.
One of the things that the more expensive irons give you is they give you quicker heating of the tip. Well, you might argue that, well, you don't really care how long it takes to heat the tip because, you know, if you're retired, you can wait the next 10 seconds each time you turn it on. But the trick is the quicker the tip heats up, that means the lower the thermal resistance is between the thing you're soldering and the heating element, which means that you, for a given wattage, you can solder and desolder heavier, you know, direct grounded copper things and not probably not PL259s with a 50 watt iron, but still, I mean, you could use, as far as I'm concerned, you could use 100 watt iron on SMT if it's temperature controlled, because it's mm-hmm. going to keep the temperature where it's going to keep the temperature. So it doesn't matter. That just gives you the limit as to how much iron you can heat up with your iron, so to speak.
I don't know the model number, but there is a continuously controlled version of the WTCPT. A little okay, more money, with you can dial it in.
Yeah.
Because Daniel, can I share a screen image here?
Yeah, that should be fine.
Okay. Bill, the what you're looking for, here's the waterfall sink down here in the screen.
Yeah.
If you double click it, you'll scroll down the window, you'll see this field marked GUI hint, and that's on all of the GUIs. They all have a GUI hint.
Okay.
If you go over to the documentation tab here, it tells you how to, it's a string of comma separated numbers that tell you how to position the widget within the display. So you have you can put it on a tab if you want, or the tab is optional if you don't have a tabbed display. And then you can put the row, the column, the row span, and the column span. So you can make the GUIs of different size on the display element. So if you click the documentation tab on the item, you'll get the help for the item.
That's very helpful, Tom. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Nathaniel.
This is what I use for removing surface mount.
Yeah, my dad had one of those. You could use it for soldering copper pipe and
yeah,
American Beauty, right? 1,000 watts.
Yeah, about 1,500 watts. It the one he had was powerful enough that you could melt down a fishing sinker.
Oh,
yeah, I've got one of those that my father used to build heath kits with.
Well, heath kits. No, this was used for plumbing. The one that my dad had.
No, this was the probably would have worked too. Well, maybe not quite that big, but it was like a half inch tip.
Yeah, that's
and that's what you use to put tube equipment together.
Yeah, my dad had one like that. I learned to solder with that.
And they do a nice job with PL259s too.
Yeah, that's true.
I still have my 100 my dual heat 140 watt soldering gun from when I was a novice back in 1974, and it works just fine.
Oh yeah,
Weller, of course.
The Weller melter. Actually, I have a super melter too. That's twice the heat power, twice the wattage.
You have a 375 watt gun.
Something like that. I forget. It's in the 200 watt range instead of the 100 watt range.
Yeah, they make a 100, 140, and they make a 200, 275, I think, and then they make the 375, which is
I think I have the 200, 275.
Yeah,
I've got the 375.
The 100, 140 that I have, but that was the very first piece of power equipment I ever bought as a kid.
Well, it's interesting because I had my dad had one of the 375s, and he'd had it forever, and it was just beat to crap. The case was cracked. The two prongs out the front were kind of loose, and it had the two lamps on the front because it was the big heavy duty one. You're not going to believe this, but I actually found a new case on eBay, brand new NOS, and I put it on the iron, and I have my dad's old iron all brand new fixed up, and I can use it again.
But what are you going to use it for?
PL259, probably.
259.
What applications do you have?
The PL259s is the best one, and it
can solder antennas with it.
Solder antenna wire.
Yeah, the other thing you can use them.
No, I definitely use my welding
cases.
The other thing you can use them for is you take the tip out, then get yourself some number 12 wire, enameled wire or bare wire. Make a coil about 4 inches in diameter, and stuff the ends into the soldering iron sleeves. Tighten up the nuts, and you've got a wonderful degaussing tool.
That's
what you
true.
Do is you hit the switch.
Wow.
You hold the switch. You bring your tool in slowly, pull it out slowly. Make sure it's about a foot or two away when you let the switch go, and yeah, it's degaussed.
There you go.
How long can you hold the key down?
Actually, quite a while. Yeah.
I've got one of the original. I've got one for degaussing color TV sets.
We used to use them at the physics lab for degaussing photomultiplier tubes.
Right.
This question is for all the OFs on the list here. How many of you made your first electromagnet with number 18 copper wire and a nail and a 1.5 volt dry cell the size of that big?
Yep.
Yeah.
I used number 24.
You hook it up and the coil heats up so that you can barely hold on to it. It's got to do great things for your dry cell.
Oh yeah.
But it was fun. The first experiments you can do with almost no stuff.
Can make a motor out of nails and wire.
Yeah. Have you seen the one where they actually take a Duracell battery and some paper clips and they make a motor out of it?
Mm-hmm.
And some ACO, they have clips like these, ACO clips, only smaller ones. Mm-hmm. And they put the battery in between here and they support it on the paper clip. And it's amazing. It can't last for very long because it doesn't have much of a coil for the motor, but it actually spins around.
Hmm. Oh, yeah.
Modern day nail. What's that, Mike?
Degausser.
Oh.
Tape degausser.
Mm-hmm. I have a bulk tape eraser too for a quarter inch tape. It's about
that. In broadcast.
yes. The 60 cycle transmitter. I never did make a spark coil transmitter, so I never got in trouble with my neighbors. Anyway, I'm looking at irons here on Mauser. Eha. Well, it looks like Weller is now Apex Tool Group.
Right. I mentioned that.
Oh, you did. I missed that.
Yep. Okay. But and of course, Weller absorbed Unger and some others. So there seems to be conglomeration going on.
Yeah. But I'm looking here, and I put the things in cost order, and it goes from 275 to 478 to 557. Then it goes up towards $1,000 for all these fancy stations. So maybe the best thing to do is look on eBay or places like that. Since I don't know about you guys, we aren't having any ham fests here because of the COVID thing still. But if that ever comes back, it's a great place to buy used stuff like that.
Yeah, swaps in the Detroit area are QRT.
Yeah.
We're starting to back up here. We've got the Tuscaloosa Ham Fest.
We had a couple of weeks ago, one in Tucson. I would say, if you're lucky, 2% of the people were in masks. Everyone else was not. Of course, it's outdoors, which helps.
Well, I mean, where we are, the only people who go to ham fests are, you know, 65 and up, and they've mostly been vaccinated. So, but yeah, we're going to have the Tuscaloosa ham fest here. I think it's the weekend before field day. So they,
is that a big fest?
Want me to, it's, no, it's not big, but anyway, I'll get a chance to give a presentation about the tangerine.
Oh,
what are the chances that I could have a prototype by then?
By field day?
Third week of June.
Yeah.
Near zero, or?
You'll have a prototype of some of the boards, maybe, but a full set is going to be difficult. It'll be close, though, so we should put you first on the list.
It would be great. I mean, yeah, I mean.
Would it help if you had, like, an RF board or a clock module to show, even if you didn't have a whole set?
Well, I mean, I would hope to be able to do a demo. I mean, so, I mean, I need the tangerine for that.
Well, I don't know. Having hardware in your hand and having a demo, those two items are spaced apart in time, I think.
Yeah, right. I know.
So you might be able to get you something to hold up and say, here it is. We're just starting to debug it. So,
yeah, that'd be good. Now, I can also do the same thing at the Huntsville Ham Fest, but that's a little bit further down the road. That's, I think, the third weekend of August.
Okay.
So
better have something by then, because they're going to run me out of town on the rail if I don't have it by DCC, which is the third week.
Scotty, yeah. Is it okay if I need some assistance that I could contact you directly?
Sure. Just send me an email.
Could you put your email in the chat to me, please?
Sure. It's wa2dfi@arl.net is one of them, which works. Okay. I'll put the other one in.
I just noticed a listing that said that the WCPT, whatever it is no longer available and replaced by a digital unit.
Yeah.
It's only a little over $100. So I found it at Test Equipment Depot.
What's the model number of the replacement?
WE1010.
Okay.
And what's the website where that is, the 1010?
I found it at Test Equipment Depot. Technic Tool is another one that sells these.
Yeah. Just don't waste your time with something that isn't temperature controlled, because
right,
you'll want to do that.
Of course, I did a lot of work with the old Unger, 33-watt, 45-watt.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I still have a couple of those sitting around. You want them? I don't.
It's kind of like, I keep in my kit.
It's kind of like my first motorcycle was a Honda 90, but I'm not going to go out and buy one because it just really kind of sucked. But it was awesome for what the money that I had at the time, at the age I was. But
well, I like the Unger irons because I can screw the element off and fold it up and stick it in a toolkit. So I've built a lot of billboards with those things, production and hobby.
I'm looking on eBay for soldering stations, and not really much that I would ever buy. Looks like tons of cheap Chinese stuff that, you know, it's, I mean, the people here built stuff. Anybody who's worked on cars, you don't want to buy cheap tools. You want to buy good tools. So, yeah. So,
DigiKey does have this new model in stock. So that seems to be what's replaced it.
Is it WE101?
WE1010.
WE1010, okay.
And DigiKey has it for $129. This other place had it for a little different.
That's Whiskey Echo 1010?
Correct.
Yeah, EDU, right? No, here's an NA. There's an EDU. I don't know what the difference is. It's about $40 more.
Oh.
Looks like it's the same exact.
NA seems to be the standard one.
Oh, it's a kit. It comes with solder and pliers and, you know, a bunch of other stuff.
Okay. Yeah, and it has the same types of tips.
But you're not really going to find anything, I think, as pointy as some of the more expensive stations, are you? Because that looks like a WTCP size tip.
Right.
Which is
I put in the chat the fine tips that I use. They are long and thin, but they work well for surface mount. I do down to 050 spacing with okay. those.
It is kind of hard when the tip's wider than the spacing between your pins.
Or is it? Yeah. Well, of course, a lot of the technique with surface mount is for the really fine stuff, you just make a big solder bridge and then you wick it off.
Yeah. Some things, though, you have trouble doing it that way.
Correct. Well, you have to tune it to how the board's been put in.
I know I had an FPGA I was doing one time that was an 050 pitch. And did the flood technique where you just run down the side and you put a bunch of solder on it. And I had two pins that for the life of me, I could not get the solder bridge out from behind. I just would not come out. I tried sucking on it. I tried solder wicking it. I tried flooding it again and wicking it again. I don't even remember how I fixed it, because one of the ways you can do it is you can heat it up and then you can bang it on the table and you can try to dislodge it that way. But that can get
cut them out with an X-Acto knife.
Those PCA 95, 90, 96, 15s.
Yeah.
Those PCA 96, 15s will do that to you.
Now, here's another technique that if you have a PC board that is pre-tinned, has solder on the pads, you often with a good, if you have a clean component, not oxidized, you can actually just heat the pin and it will solder. Flow the solder from the PC board onto the pin and it works very well.
Like you said, if you have flux, external flux, that works pretty well.
Yeah, that's right. That's another key thing for working with solder mounted. So you have to have liquid flux.
A little bottle with a syringe type needle. Right. It's not it's not sharp, but it's a tube that you can apply drops of flux to.
You do need to get more than one syringe. The flux eventually eats the rubber of the syringe plunger.
I just use a squeeze bottle.
Yeah.
And eventually it gets all gunked up and you pitch it and get a new one.
Right.
But I'm looking for even soldering tips. Come on, they got to have a category.
Look under EAE sales in Indianapolis or Indiana. EAE sales. He's got everything soldering.
We're down to one electronics store in the Northeast, in New England. You do it. And I heard that Fry's has gone under.
Fry's is gone in Phoenix. Both stores.
Well, I think all together.
They closed them all.
Yeah, I've been to the one in, San Jose or whatever. One of the big ones, but it's sad that it's gone.
Yeah.
I would recommend for a surface mount, which I use quite a bit. Actually, not this station, but it's the FX951 from Hackle.
Yeah, I know that name. It's kind of taking over.
Yeah, I've been using Pace for years. Where I work, we use Pace. But I've noticed that the usability and quality of Hackle seems to overrun Pace. So what I would recommend as a starter for surface mount soldering is the FX91 station. It's a single channel station with the handle and the T15-I tip. So it'll probably run you a little under $300, but it's a very good quality tool and we're gonna have it for years. And I would definitely recommend that for surface mount, or at least starting off.
That is the thing with the most of the name brands. You're muted.
Could you put that information into the chat, please?
He did.
One thing about the name brands is too that every part's replaceable, so you'll have it forever.
Okay. The last chat I saw was Hayco USA.
That's what Jonathan's saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're kind of the new kids on the block, but they're doing well.
Can you draw blood with the tip, Jonathan?
Yes, actually, that tip is extremely sharp. They have other tips too, but that's my favorite tip that I use for chip components and their small pitches.
Oh, and I'll give you another tip, Jay. Get some a tin of flux that you can dip your iron in that'll help retin the iron and keep solder idling on the tip. I came in the other night and left my iron on overnight and I forgot about it. And that just ruins tips faster than you can
this stuff.
Leave it. Yeah,
tip that's tinner.
That's tip tinner. That's it. That's worth its weight in gold. And you know,
Contact East, that's the name I remember. I think they got swallowed. Who did, are they still around?
I helped out at the ARRL kit for them back at Hambinchin when they had the ARRL kit for them, when they still had it. And the biggest problem that all the people had at the kit for them was that the irons were not tinned. And what they would do, they were teaching them how to do this, and they would make the solder joint, and then they would wipe the iron and put it in the holder. So the iron always idled with no solder on it. And after about 2 hours of doing that, you couldn't even solder with it anymore because the solder wouldn't even stick to the tip. So I told them, look, get some of this tip tinner like Dave showed you. And the trick is put a lot of idling solder on the tip and put it in the holder. Let it idle with solder on it.
Right.
When you're ready to make a joint, then you wipe it off, get a nice clean tip, and then you make the joint, and then add some extra solder and put it back in the holder. Well, after we started doing that, it took about 15 or 20 minutes of doing that before the irons became really usable again. And the one woman I was helping, her husband had been a ham for 50 years, and she decided finally she was going to build a kit. And so I think she built an electronic keyer of all things. And she was having just a devil of a time because she put the iron on the joint and add solder and it wouldn't melt. It just wouldn't melt. Even if you touched the solder to the iron itself, it wouldn't melt because it was all oxidized. And by the time she got about halfway through the kit, it was just easy in making joints because you put the iron on there and touch the solder to the pin, not to the iron, and it would melt. So it would actually transfer heat. And the trick was leaving the idling solder on it. So whatever that's worth.
I'm now, this is, tells me how old this tinner is. And so it doesn't go very fast.
Doesn't go bad either.
Got it from Contact East, which is now Jensen Tools.
Wow, Jensen Tools is still in business?
Yeah.
Wow.
And they swallowed Contact East and a bunch of other guys.
When we started our business in 1995, we bought a tool kit from Jensen Tools.
Mm-hmm.
That was the basis of our starting of the tool kit at the company.
I actually purchased a lot of paste tips from Jensen Tools when I got an MBT250 for my home bench. A lot of the tips for the pencil and the solder extractor came from Jensen Tools.
Yeah. Well, they had a local office here, and I could just walk in and buy a tool kit. So that's what we did.
Daniel, you look like you're ready to go QRT.
I think I am. I was just trying to figure out a good time to say that. So I think I might say 73 for tonight.
It's not snowing there, is it?
No, I've got to take a new picture of my backyard here. I'll have to change it around. It was pretty cold last week, though. We did get some snow last week, so hopefully it'll start warming up now.
But we're supposed to get rain today.
Yeah.
But I think they lied to us.
We're going below freezing tonight.
Oh,
yeah, we had a couple below freezing last week, and I'm very afraid that a lot of our crops may have gotten wiped out for this season.
Next Saturday is supposed to be 103 here, and that means
have it.
No more single digit temperatures much after that for highs. Right. Once it starts with over 100, you don't get any respite until October.
I'm heading out also, guys.
So I think it's going to wrap it up
good
for
night,
tonight,
everyone.
Catch you the next time.
Good night. Very good.
We'll see you next time.
73.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. I'm going to check out also.
Good luck.
Take care.
Good luck with your soldering equipment.
Yep. Thank you. Thanks for your advice, guys. Take care.
Good luck with all that.
73 to all.
73. Now, what was, Jonathan, what were you saying about differential receivers, transmitters being hard to get?
Yeah, the two parts that you found that were out of stock.
Oh, your LVDS.
Yeah. If they're not obsoleted, I was going to say, well, let's stick with those in the design anyway.
Those won't be obsoleted. They're used all over the place. There are two different series the TI both carries. I can't remember if I gave you both numbers, but because TI merged, took in National Semiconductor.
Yeah.
National has different numbers than TI, but they all work the same. So there's a 90 version, and then I think that's National's. And then there's the whatever TI has. But, but yeah, don't be afraid to design with those parts. The pinout is universal.
Oh, well then, okay. Yeah, then we'll just stick with that. Because I don't really know the exact schedule for this VLF board yet.
Right. Yeah, and has anyone gotten the A to D converters, found them anywhere? I checked a couple of sources in China. They were gone.
The last that I checked, I checked a couple of weeks ago, there was not any stock. I believe TI had stock if you wanted to order from TI directly.
No, last I checked, they didn't have any.
Oh, okay. Well, then maybe
not the 6140.
Yeah.
And my suggestion was that the 6120, if they have prototyping quantities, it's a preliminary part. So they might be willing to let us have a couple of the 6120s to at least work with. But do you have one of the eval boards for the 6140?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so you have at least one part, even if we don't can't put it on another board. At least you can work through the programming of it.
Yeah, and a carrier board could be made for the evaluation module part of it. There are two parts. There's the USB controller, and then there's the actual eval module that TI swaps out for its different parts. So we could take that and just make a carrier board, and that could be what we use for programming.
We're all going to have to work around stuff here because it's probably going to get worse before it gets better.
Yeah, that's normal, but I'm sure...
I haven't seen this kind of a hiccup in a while.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on with the fabs, but there's a pretty crazy short. There's a lot of shortages. So,
well, part of it is just scheduling because of the epidemic. And my understanding is that industries like the automotive industry stopped ordering parts, so the fabs shut down. And now they want the parts, and the fabs aren't up to speed yet.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
and it takes quite a bit to.
And God knows how many parts were stuck on that ship in the, stuck with the Suez Canal business. They may all resolve once they get around to Africa.
Well, yeah, we'll just work with what we have.
Yeah, I'd say probably reasonable, stay the course and go ahead and lay things, we can lay things out and, the parts will become available eventually.
And the other models in that family of the A to D converter, I believe
that's true. They're pin compatible, as I believe.
Yeah.
And the 6140 is the highest performance, but if we could get any of the five or the three version, they would work too, at least to get started.
Yeah, I think that they use a lot of the same register values too.
Yeah, I did look for stock on those too, and I haven't been able to find it either. But
I wonder what they're used for, because I haven't seen a lot of applications for those or equipment that uses those. I'm not really sure.
Well, there are automotive uses. There's high-end stereo, well, even low-end stereo, or quad uses. There's actually quite a market of semi-pro audio.
Oh, that's true. Well, yeah, I was kind of looking at like pro audio USB interfaces,
Right.
And, most of them don't really say what A to D and D to A converters that they use. So it's kind of hard to tell, and you have to hope that someone takes one apart and takes pictures of the board, and then you could find out. That's how I found out with the Behringer.
That uses a Cirrus part?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's too bad Cirrus didn't work out, but their filters are crap.
Yeah, well, see, for the low frequency stuff for the natural radio, a lot of people are using them in the VLF groups that I'm part of, and they have very good success, but a lot of them don't really use them in the higher frequencies.
Yeah, at lower sample rates, they're fine, but they've cheaped out on the filters at the higher sample rates. It kind of defeats the purpose of the higher sample rates.
Yeah, I was hoping that I could find some sort of pro audio device with this ADD converter, so I could.
Yeah, I'll have to look around. I design those.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what I wanted to do, the drawback with this evaluation board is that you can't use it as a USB sound card.
Yeah, that's interesting. It doesn't have that functionality.
Well, see, it does, except you have to initialize the registers in the Windows evaluation software.
Ah.
Once you initialize them, then it turns into a regular USB sound card.
Oh, I see. But you can't just plug it in and have it run, you're saying.
Right.
Oh, that's interesting.
And
I'd have thought they'd have a program on the board to set those.
Well, I think the way that they wanted to write the software, the evaluation software, I'm not really sure what their thinking was, but they probably wanted to make the board as user friendly as possible to be able to change and configure everything about every register. So that's why that I think that they did it that way. And I asked TI, or at least on their message board, and they didn't have any information on how to program the USB interface with the appropriate register configuration.
Oh, interesting.
So it's really unfortunate if you want to evaluate this on something other than Windows, and I wanted to evaluate it on Linux, and it doesn't look like I could do that. So I was on the search for some sort of pro audio interface that uses this, but I didn't find any yet.
Well, it's a pretty new part. Maybe that's part of what's going on.
Mauser says August 23rd.
Oh, that's new. That's better than what we've seen.
500 expected, 823.
Oh, cool.
So I suspect if we put an order in, we'd be getting the queue.
That would be probably reasonable.
Yeah.
How many do you think we would build?
Initially, probably no more than 10.
And let's see, what do they want for? $10 a piece.
Yep.
$100. That's not bad.
You know what? I could probably sneak that order in to the HPSD or to the Tangerine stuff that we're doing now.
Okay.
And you want the 6140, you don't care what package, right?
Well, there's
other choices.
Apparently there's two packages. I'm not sure. Maybe that's just temperature ranges. There were two part numbers.
They're two part numbers, but it has to do with how they're reeled.
The reel sizes, yeah.
Right, yes. Okay.
Yeah. Only one package type then.
Right. Yeah, either one is fine. Yeah, I'm at the web page now.
Yeah, if you go in and say under availability, it says 1500 on order. If you click view dates.
It's the only difference is how big the tape, the reel is. One is a 3000 and one is a 250 part reel.
Right. And we're buying cut tape anyway, so it doesn't
matter. It doesn't matter.
No.
So let's see what I can do. There's a half a dozen parts that we have to deal with on the Tangerine anyway, that we have to figure out how we're going to get.
Well, yeah, if there's some money left over and Nathaniel's okay with it, and you know, I would say order them. At least we have them.
And there's never any money left over, Jonathan, but there's surreptitious you know, sneaky stuff that we do because we have to, because we know we're not going to be able to get them.
Oh, okay.
But you know, when it says 823, it doesn't really tell you when the next order after that is going to be. So it might be
right.
You know, because the most of the places I'm looking at claim 35 week lead time.
Wow.
More than 6 months. That's like right. December.
Yeah, we were saying November.
Yeah, but Mauser says 20 weeks. So let's see, is August 23rd 20 weeks?
That sounds.
See, it's about 4 months, May, June, July. Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
About 20 right. weeks. Oh, well.
Yeah, but the going price is about $10 in quantity 10.
Yeah.
So that's reasonable.
And you really don't shave off that much if we're going to 25.
I think for single unit quantities, I think it was like $12.
$11.24 is what I'm saying.
$10.33 for 10, and $9.96 for 25, and $8.72 for 100.
Right.
Which we're not going to buy yet.
Not at this time.
That's not bad.
You're thinking a run of 10. Okay. So what? Interesting. I think that's doable.
I mean, I definitely no more than 10, because what I would like to do is I would like to send these to people who live in areas that are conducive for VLF. So places where Nathaniel lives and areas where you could find some low hum levels. It's not really easy to find such an area.
Yeah.
Most people live in the suburbs, and
with this chip, your upper end is what, 200 kilohertz? 200 more is higher than that, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's, you know, the 192 kilohertz sampling. Well, we're hoping for 100 kilohertz.
But this chip goes up to 768K sampling.
Right. It does.
Filters don't.
That's what's really nice about it is. It really has a very high,
but the filters don't go up that high for cutoff frequency, do they? I thought they still cut off at like 350 or 500, something lower than 768.
I can't remember, but what attracted me to it is that at the you know, order of 200 kilohertz sampling, it has a very good filter, whereas the Cirrus part we were looking at has a very relaxed filter. That was not adequate for what we want. Alias is a lot. So this one's got some decent filtering on it. But yeah, it's interesting. You can sample up to 768K. We could encroach on the broadcast band.
That's right.
Yeah, it's a really great part for this sort of thing.
Apparently it's a great part for someone else too, because they bought them all up.
Yeah, somebody's using them.
I'm really interested to see the performance on the lower end for the natural radio stuff. But this seems like a choice.
By lower end, what are you talking?
I'm talking below 30 kilohertz down to like 30 hertz.
Yeah, well, they'll do that just fine. That's the audio band.
Yeah.
That's what they're made for. You got to have them very good in the 20 to 20 kilohertz. And then for people like me, you have to go above that. But 20 to 20 kilohertz is considered normal hearing.
You start getting to 1 over F noise when you get down. Well, that's probably way down low, like below 100 hertz.
Well, right? It depends. You got to watch that in your analog amplifiers. Because depending upon the type of amplifier you use, you can start getting 1 over F at 10 kilohertz and below. But the ones that we use for high-end audio have a 1 over F corner down around 10 hertz.
And that would be like these, right? Be the same thing?
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're going to try to resolve our parts availability issues tomorrow. So I'll sneak if I can sneak these in.
Okay.
Yeah. It'll be good to see if they'll let us put them on order.
it's on the same project. So, because we have some other ones that aren't coming in until the first week in June. So we're getting primed for assembly. That's on the data engine. So we'll do the other boards first, and then we'll fire. That's why I was telling Bill, if we don't get the part till like the 6th of June, the third week in June is probably good. I mean, he may get a board, but he's not going to get anything tested out because we're going to just have had it put together by that time, depending on the scheduling, I guess, with our CM. But the data engine is not for the faint of heart. There's 567 parts of the data engine.
How many?
567 parts.
Uh-huh.
Guys, it's funny because we save some money by having our CM hand assemble and then reflow solder the boards. So the clock module has like 170 components, and the RF is even less. And so he was being real facetious because I kept asking him, well, how much leader do you want on the parts? Because if he has to feed them into the machine to pick and place, he's got to have leader on the parts. So that means we got to buy extra of the cheap parts like resistors and caps to get the leader. And he kind of got tired of me asking him how much leader he wanted. So he says, look, we're going to hand place all these boards unless you got more than 300 components on it. So I wrote him back and I said, well, the next one coming has got 575. I think that's more than 300. So what do you want to do? So he's still going to hand place it because it's split almost evenly between the front and the back. And so there's less than 300 on each side, if you will. It's just that one side has all the BGAs and all the fancy stuff on it, and the other side is all just resistors and caps. But he's going to hand assemble it, so that's okay. It's expensive, but it's not as expensive as paying for a machine setup for 25 boards.
Right.
So we do it that way. And then we go to production, then we'll pay for a machine setup, but we'll amortize it over 500 boards.
Yeah, we actually, at Dartmouth, we have one of the carousel machines that we use to populate our boards. We have the students hand assemble them.
Well, it's a pick and place machine, right?
Well, it basically gives you the part in a bin and tells you where the part is supposed to go, and you place it.
Oh, okay. Not automated then.
Not automated.
Yeah, because this pick and place machine that this guy has, our CM has, it has multiple placement arms. And so they have to program
right.
The parts on such yep. that they
oh,
don't.
Oh, I know how those over. Work too. But yeah, but yeah. It actually is quite effective. And I've done contract.
It's much faster because you
sent out contract work to houses that use the carousel and the laser pointer and the person who places the component.
Yeah.
So it actually points at the location for it, gives you the bin that's holding the part, and you put the part in.
Yeah.
And that's actually pretty good. It's fairly effective.
Yeah. Especially because the machine's handling the part, right? You're just,
right.
You've got optical view and a robot arm and you control it, right?
No, no robot arm. You're placing it by hand, but it's telling you this is the part and this is where you put it.
Okay.
So low error rate.